Here's a poem called Whammy 5. You've a je ne sais quoi that enchants. How your scent makes my arteries dance. Whammy scent from above. Come to Papa, my love. Lunch at Dick's. A delicious romance.
The voice and the poetry writing of Chris Cook, whose book Damn Good Cookie is coming out in a very few days in an opening on the 18th of June. And with that final line about Dick's, we certainly have that Chris Cook is a Spokane poet in the best sense of the word, including the very fact that you once introduced me to the fact that if you're truly an insider, you know the Dick's back menu and the things that they don't advertise. That's true?
That's exactly right. Those grilled cheese sandwiches that only a select few are in on, and the coleslaw side order is probably the healthiest thing on that menu.
And I guess as long as we're going to go there and hear a metaphor or two today, I say that's a certain kind of metaphor for you, because I've always known, and we're just going to reveal this right up front, Chris Cook and I have known each other for more than half of our lives, but I've always known that you knew all the strange and interesting sides of so much of life. And so in your poetry that we've seen emerge, I think that's where we're going to go tonight, to find the great places you take us. And can you encapsulate what it is about yourself that sees the world differently than many other people?
Maybe it's got something to do with that back menu at Dick's. Maybe it's got something to do with the fact that I'm a musician, former yo-yo champion. I tend to get into oddities. Maybe there's some kind of a brew, a strange concoction that has something to do with it. I was raised on good poetry, courtesy of my grandfather. I was also raised on kind of twisted children's poetry as well, even though I didn't start writing myself until relatively recently, maybe 15 years ago or so.
And what made you start?
Actually, it was a challenge. I like wordplay, and I like puzzles. And Dan Webster over at the Spokesman Review started a tradition right before St. Patrick's Day of having a limerick contest. And so that was an easy way to get into it. Just like the limerick I just read for you, it's just 5 lines long. It's basically 2 rhymes. And there's rhythm involved, and the musician in me loves that rhythm. And you can crank out a limerick rather quickly. And so there's satisfaction in getting that done and hopefully not having too many predictable rhymes.
Illuminating a couple things, Chris Cook is a trumpet player in the Spokane Symphony and many other venues, including that lovely way that you expressed being a trumpet player in 3 places on New Year's Eve in one of these poems, which I really, really enjoyed. And, of course, amidst all of those strange things, you forgot to mention your foosball career.
That's true. Yes.
Well, anyway, we're here for poetry, and we're here for some of the poems, the range of some of the range of the poetry of the new book, Damn Good Cookie. So your opening poem, I think, gives us a good place to start. Go for it.
Here's a poem called Love Down Under. Way up high in the trees, in the land they call Oz, a self-conscious koala with oversized paws and a body she felt was more chubby than lean was obsessed with remaining unseen. She felt far more at home, staying off of the grid, behind thick eucalyptus leaves. That's where she hid. And she clung there, protected from anyone's view, till a voice right behind her said, "Boo!" She instinctively tightened her grip on the tree. Then she nervously asked, "Are you talking to me? You're the first to have noticed me here in this spot." And he said to her, "How could I not?" She said, "I am aware how I look. Don't be rude. I'd be out in plain sight if I want to be viewed, if I want my unlovable shape to be seen, the result of some mutated gene. If I want these big Frankenstein paws to be watched, and this mole on my cheek and my ears badly botched, all these terrible things in one body residing, don't you think I would not have been hiding?" In the silence that followed, more potent than words, interrupted by callings of tropical birds, he smiled sadly, then said in a voice filled with pain, "I'm so sorry. Please let me explain. How could I not means it wasn't a choice. How could I not gave me cause to rejoice. And though how could I not have the purest intention, I guess I should probably mention, I've always believed I'm too small for a male. I'm too short in the arms and too long in the tail, and my eyes do not match and my voice is too high. I've had days when I've wanted to die. But then you came along, and I loved what I saw, an enchanting koala without any flaws. Then she looked at him differently, gave him a smile, and they gently held paws for a while. Eucalyptus leaves instantly burst with new taste, and their eyes perceived dewdrops as jewel encased, as if suddenly feelings long dead had awoken, and nothing more had to be spoken. They had spent their lives thinking their looks were all wrong, that the world was a place where they'd never belong, but they learned they were just as they should have appeared, because normal is wonderfully weird.
Love Down Under, written and read by Chris Cook. First, Chris, is that it's one of a lot of poems that you've written on something similar of pointing out inadequacies that aren't inadequacies. You would agree that you've written a fair number of poems like that, when somebody who's self-critical realizes they should have been not been worrying so much?
Sure, yeah. Isn't it a part of what we realize as we grow older, if we're paying attention? Mm-hmm. You know, we're all in this together.
Yeah, and I do want to say that that's one of the really great hallmarks of your poems, is the sense of what it meant at the end. Throughout this, we're going to talk about some of the different poetic moves you make and the things you do, because you pointed out in that ending, but they learned they were just as they should have appeared, because normal is wonderfully weird, that you broke the rhythm sequence of the poem in the end. Was that just to let us know it ended, or where did that come from?
Actually, that truncated last line appears throughout that whole poem, but I do owe that to maybe the lyrics of Randy Newman. I can think of a couple of songs that I know of his that use that that scheme, that meter that gets chopped on the last line, maybe Tom Waits as well. And so some of the experimentation has come because of lyricists, songwriters.
Makes good sense. And I've known some of those same songs that you're alluding to in that one. These are poems from Chris's about-to-be-released book, Damn Good Cookie. And you often take on different people in our civilization, in our culture. You have a couple about Dr. Seuss in here. That famous salient interviewer's line, where does the idea come from? You just wake up one day and think about Dr. Seuss, or a quality of Dr. Seuss you think needs to be brought out? Or?
Well, I suppose we all grow up with Dr. Seuss, so it's already there. It's just a question of what was it that brought it to my attention. I had written an earlier poem called The Geisel Revisal, and I was probably trying to connect with people live, because for a few years I was involved with poetry slams, and that's really about connecting as immediately as possible. And so this poem takes up many years later, where The Geisel Revisal leaves off.
Yeah, Dr. Seuss breaks free. And then also, while the internal stuff maybe more matters to English majors than to the public, just as an overview of this poem, you use several different forms and within it. You don't just keep to the same form, do you?
Right, and that's part of the breaking free that's alluded to in the title.
And so what are a few of the forms that you have in here? You referred to him within the poem.
Exactly, yes. We've got form poetry, we've got free verse, there's a haiku, and there's a reference to list poems as well.
Well, let's go ahead and enjoy this. This is Chris Cook reading Dr. Seuss Breaks Free.
There were tangerine trees, there were marmalade skies. I saw cellophane green with my colorblind eyes. From a distance, the house looked cartoonish and fun, and its colors were lit by the bright morning sun. As the camera zoomed in through the outermost wall, it progressed to a room at the end of the hall. Dr. Seuss and the missus were lying in bed when a nasty idea popped into his head. He said, "Baby, I know that it works every time, Dr. Seuss has the power to seduce you with rhyme. I am Theodore Geisel. I'm Seuss. I am Sam. Gonna get up inside of your green eggs and ham. Oh, I feel good like James Brown. I'm a sex machine. Heh! Mrs. Seuss's response was to simply say, meh. She said, darling, for years you're the man I've adored. Please, I don't want to hurt you, but Teddy, I'm bored. I don't know how it happened, dear Theodore G., but your rhymes are no longer seductive to me. Anapestic quadrameter just makes me tired, and I'm worried that maybe your mojo's expired. He said, baby, don't joke about something like that. I can make you meow like the Cat in the Hat. You're as hot and as juicy as Whoville roast beast. Do you want to make love? She said, not in the least. Though it pained him, he knew what he needed to do. He would change how he wrote. He would try something new. He locked himself in his study for a very long time. He neither ate nor slept. When he finally emerged, he had a list poem called 137 Reasons Why I Still Love Your Habit of Tucking Your Hair Behind Your Ear. He had memorized it. Number one was, because I get to see it every day. The other 136 were just as heartfelt. He'd also written her his first haiku. Beloved Audrey, forget form, rhyme, and meter. You are poetry. He said, I'm sorry if it's not very good, but I hope you like it anyway. She said, don't. Then he said, I might slip and go back to my rhymes. And you can, Audrey said, any number of times, but what matters is that you can choose to be free. You have proven you can, and you did it for me, and I think, Dr. Seuss, that that's sexy as hell. Let's go see if your mojo is healthy as well. They crawled back into bed, where their passions were stirred, and it all came to be through the love of the word.
Wow, a poem which explains itself beautifully throughout. Thank you, Dr. Seuss Breaks Free. Chris Cook's poetry from his forthcoming poetry book, Damn Good Cookie. Chris and I have talked about some of the different things he leans on, and there's plenty of them. We have a couple here that have to do with times of one's life, ages of one's life. Why don't you start out with this one that takes you way back to when you were young?
This is called Furt. We moved so often that I had come to appreciate those who reached out first. It was the start of fourth grade, and I was the new kid yet again. It didn't take long for them to start calling me Cookie, like at all my previous schools. I was told to keep away from a girl they called Furt. When I asked why, they said it was because she was gross, that she had a bladder problem. Her real name was Debbie Johnson. She was tall, blonde, looked a little older than the rest of us, and she had these deep, sad eyes. On the playground, whenever she got too close, everyone screamed, "Ooh, Furt!" and ran away. The only time I was aware of her problem was once during class when she suddenly appeared between our desks. She was quietly crouched on the floor, mopping up after herself with some Kleenex. We briefly locked eyes, and there was a shame in hers that went on forever. They also said, please don't tell anyone. Later, during recess, we had used waxed paper on the big metal slide with the two bumps to make it fast. I was the first to try it out, and I had the bright idea of going down head first. Back then, the surfaces of playgrounds were still made of cement. I hit the first bump going so fast that I went airborne. The next thing I hit was the pavement, leaving me bloody and dazed. I lay there on my back, and when my vision finally cleared, I found that I was looking up into the compassionate eyes of Debbie Johnson. She was the only one who had come to help me. I paused for a moment, then I got up and screamed, "Ooh, Furt!" and ran away.
Wow, children on the playground. That's Furt, written by and performed by Chris Cook. These are poems that have to do with a time of one's life, but Chris, you said that tortoise time has has a lot of interesting things about it.
It does. It actually started out, I suppose, sitting in the back row of the Spokane Symphony, performing one of my all-time favorite tone poems by Richard Strauss, Don Quixote. A tone poem is a poem without words, where the musicians essentially become the poem, or we convey the poem. It's like living inside of a poem. That one has always meant a lot to me. And it just so happened that within days of having performed that, I saw the likeness of Picasso's Don Quixote in the form of a tattoo on my friend Michael Schomburg's arm. And I think that's what generated this parable called Tortoise Time.
And so, in more free verse, let's hear that.
The young boy hopped from rock to rock as he happily made his way down to the lakeshore at the start of their family vacation. He was about to step on an especially large stone when a voice said, "My dear boy, do be careful." The boy asked, "Who said that?" Then an old, bald, scaly head peeked out from within the stone and said, "It is I, Herman de la Mancha." The boy said, "A tortoise." Herman said, "Yes, well, I suppose I am that, too." The boy said, "We learned about you in school. You can live to be like 200 years old. So how old are you?" Herman said, "I'm afraid that's something I've not paid attention to." Herman was dignified and chivalrous, regaling the boy with wondrous tales of his adventures and conquests. When the boy was called in for dinner, Herman said, "Do watch your step, boy. My love is near. She's stepped away for just a moment, but she'll be right back. She's lovely, you know." He said it with conviction and a faraway look in his eyes. Years later, the boy returned as a man and brought his young daughter and son. It was his weekend to have them. The man led them down to the lake and was stunned to find Herman still there among the rocks. Herman did not look surprised. The man introduced his children to Herman, who then continued his fanciful stories, seemingly from the point they'd left off 20 years earlier. Before the man and his children left, Herman said, "Do watch your step. My love is near. She's stepped away for just a moment, but she'll be right back. She's lovely, you know." The man said, "She's gone again?" Herman said, "No, she's still gone, but one must have faith, boy. She'll be back soon. We've got our whole lives in front of us. And you know, I'll be delighted for you to meet her." The man tried to smile, but he knew that sometimes love doesn't go according to plan. Many, many years passed. The man was now 80 and in poor health. Something compelled him to return to the lake for the first time in 50 years. He was stooped, frail, and alone. At first, he wasn't sure he had even come to the right place. All the new lake houses with their trendy river rock landscaping had taken the place of the little old cabins that he had remembered from his youth. He hobbled down to the water and said a few private words to the lake because it was the one thing unaffected by time. As he turned to leave, a rock underfoot that looked familiar suddenly moved. The man gasped in disbelief. "Herman!" Then the rock next to Herman also moved, and a lovely little bald female head peeked out from within it. The old man was overcome with emotion. Herman looked him in the eye and said, "Dear boy, I told you so."
Chris Cook reading this poem representing that whole range, Tortoise Time. Poetry from Chris Cook, whose next book, Damn Good Cookie, comes out on the 18th, on that Saturday at 7 o'clock. It will be a poetry reading and book signing at, appropriately enough, Auntie's Bookstore. And I'm told there's even a rumor that the title of the book, Damn Good Cookie, might burst into an aromatic three-dimensional form. Is that possible?
Entirely possible. Batch Bake Shop will be baking up batches of oatmeal scotchies available, courtesy of my mom, Jenny Schuyler, actually, who insisted that we have damn good cookies available for everyone there.
The the least that can be done. But anyway, Chris Cook, who, as we talked at the beginning of this show, got bit by poetry 15, 20, X number of years ago, and it's taken over so much of his life, and you've had, this is not an obituary or anything, but you've had such a rich time of poetry over the last couple of decades. It's been lovely.
Yeah, and that poetry bug that bit me was the writing bug, but my grandfather raised me on the poetry of Bill Stafford, who later became the Poet Laureate of Oregon. So that's when I was really little. And my grandfather himself, Don Grant, was a poet. And that was back in the days when you had pen pals who were, in his case, very good famous poets. And they shared freely. And I just saw an elderly man come to life as if it was some kind of fountain of youth. Every time he shared a poem with me live, there was a dancing in his eyes and a spring in his step. And I always knew that poetry was capable of that.
And you had an also recent experience, even keeping some of those words alive that just happened to you.
Absolutely. I just got back from Dartmouth College. My younger son, Grant, attends. And that also happens to be the institution that houses the Robert Frost collection. And I went into the library totally on a whim and ended up seated before the actual poetry journals of Robert Frost, one of which spanned from 1900 to 1958. The other one was from 1950, all in his fountain pen. And all of those poets' thoughts were right there in front of me, and I was free to take as much time as I wanted and as many pictures as I wanted and to just identify with him, see his thought process, see the hundreds of poems that never actually made it into published forms, just the germ of the idea that all poets have to go through, but just pages and pages where the first line is story about and then a new adventure. And the next line, story about and a new adventure. And I don't know how many of those came to fruition, or just random doodlings, or a page that was the result of a hike that he took where he pulled up a sprig from the ground and put it between those pages, and it was still loose between those pages. It was pretty powerful.
And as you have written poetry over these last couple decades, you've often spoken to me about the work you do, that you don't just kind of whip off the poem and you're done with it. It takes working and reworking. Does this usually happen over an intense period when you shut out everything and just do it, or is it a longer thing of returning to it?
I do have many poems that are in partial form that may never come to fruition, as we just talked about. Creatively, I ride waves, periodic waves, where I will be able to spend more time with it, and I'm just more creative somehow. I don't have to write poetry for a living. I'm not on any kind of a time schedule, and so I have that luxury of being able to wait it out until it comes to me. And so sometimes, there are peaks and there are valleys. I think with the challenge of form poetry, if I'm doing something like that, is to make sure that I'm not predictable. Certainly the rhyme is not predictable, and maybe the storyline is not predictable. If I've failed in either of those, then I'm not doing very well. I don't ever want to sound like a greeting card, and which is why I don't do a lot of form poetry anymore, or I experiment with new forms that I've never heard of before. I just sometimes listen for an opening line that suggests the meter or the form itself. If there's a line in my head that I know that's still going to be there after a bunch of edits, then sometimes I'll try to listen to it carefully.
And some of those become poems. Well, let's go out, this book, Damn Good Cookie, let's go out with one that I've heard you deliver in public before, and a poem that that works, I know well, on a lot of different levels. Go ahead.
This is called Goodnight, Fred. In the great green room, there was a telephone and a red balloon and a picture of the cow jumping over the moon. On the television set, there was a trolley car and a neighborhood and a man in a sweater who was very, very good. There was Daniel Striped Tiger and Lady Elaine, and patiently taking the time to explain. There was Mr. McFeely with Speedy Delivery and how to dress warm when we're freezing and shivery, and teaching how sneakers are properly laced, and how to make projects with scissors and paste, and puppets like Friday the 13th, a king, and serious talks about serious things like the death of a pet and disease and divorce, explaining the anger, the guilt, the remorse, how it's not a child's fault and it never will be. It's so hard when you're 8 and your sister is 3. He taught us with patience and kindness and love that despite all the bad, there's a goodness above. Unlike other adults, he did not condescend, so he spoke to us just as though we were a friend. First time I saw his earnest style, his nerdy look, his cheesy smile, I thought, come on, you can't be real. No one's like this. What's your deal? But through the years, he proved me wrong, just bit by bit and song by song. He sang about us being neighbors and such, how we're growing inside, how we matter so much, how it's such a good feeling just being alive. And then one day, he wasn't. The day that Mr. Rogers died, a shaken planet stopped and cried. So, good night, sneakers. Good night, sweater. Good night, show that made us better. Good night, trolley. Good night, bed. Good night, childhood. Good night, Fred.
Chris Cook reading Good Night, Fred from his forthcoming book, Damn Good Cookie, which will be released on Saturday the 18th at 7 o'clock at Auntie's Bookstore. Chris, thank you for allowing yourself to get bit by poetry.
Ah, my pleasure, Vinny.